Welcome, everyone. Welcome, colleagues, friends, and students, and other scholars from around the school. I'm Fran Tonkas. I'm the head of Department of Sociology here at the LSE, and I'm really just here to welcome you and to welcome our guests, which we're going to do serially, actually. So let me introduce the editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Sociology, Daniel Lawrenson, who will say a few words on behalf of the journal. Daniel.
So, hi everybody, and thank you for being here. As Fran said, I'm Daniel Lawrenson. I'm an associate professor at Swarthmore College, and I also had a very formative postdoc here, which is part of why I have the connection that I do. I was associate editor of the British Journal of Sociology until last August. Now I'm the editor-in-chief for a bit here. The reason I'm associate editor, though, that I want to sort of recognize, this is the first public event since Nigel Dodd passed, and I know he would have loved to see this event. He would have been a big fan of JP's book, so I just want to recognize that. The BJS is the successful journal it is, in large part because of the work that Nigel did to really renovate it when he took over, and I got to work with him for almost 6 years. I'm also really excited for this panel. It's full of excellent people who you'll be introduced to in a minute. It's on a topic that defines the work experience of every academic in the UK. And I think increasingly, although we don't have the ref in the US, these sorts of forces are shaping academia well beyond the UK as well. So it's an incredibly important topic and an important book. The event will actually be chaired by Gurminder Bhambra, who's a professor of postcolonial and decolonial studies in the Department of International Relations in the School of Global Studies at the University of Sussex. Professor Bhambra is president of the British Sociological Society, a fellow of the British Academy, and a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences. She's the author of three monographs, including Colonialism and Modern Social Theory, that just came out in 2021 with John Holmwood, who's also on the panel, as well as a book called Connected Sociologies and another called Rethinking Modernity, Postcolonialism and the Sociological Imagination. She also has six co-edited edited volumes and more peer-reviewed articles on her page than I could count. She's a leader in thinking critically and sociologically about the history and functioning of, among other things, the British state. So I think she's really the perfect person to chair a panel on JP's book, which is about how the British state, among other forces, shapes academia. So I will turn it over to her. Thank you very much.
Thanks. So thank you, first of all, to the Department of Sociology here at the LSE and to the British Journal of Sociology for hosting this event. I'd really like to extend my welcome also to you all to this panel, which is reflecting on the really quite superb new book by Juan Pablo Pardo Guerra called The Quantified Scholar. Now, in this book, Juan Pablo examines the research evaluation processes that have been going on within the UK. We have known them as the RAE, the REF, and so on. And they're effectively quite a regular feature of academic life. The last one, completed in 2021, and preparations are likely already underway across institutions for the next one, whenever that will be. And in the book, and I'll let Juan Pablo sort of outline the key themes of the book, but I just want to set out a little bit about what it is that he's doing. And what he does within the book is to examine the ways in which the processes of evaluation and then the related distribution of funds that's associated with these forms of evaluation have quantified the worth of knowledge and in the process are potentially changing the very nature of scholarship itself. And the focus of the book and the panel today is specifically on the social sciences. And so in that sense, I think it's really nice as well that the LSE Department of Sociology and the BJS, which have been such sort of institutions of sociology and the social sciences more generally, are hosting this discussion. I should say that I was first alerted to Juan Pablo's book by responses to it by colleagues who are in the US, actually. And one of the things that they mentioned was that they thought that it would create something of a stir within British sociology and UK academia more generally. Because if there's something that academics like beyond all other things, it's to discuss the anxieties and mortifications of academic life. And of course, the REF has contributed quite considerably to these troubles. Now, whilst REF 2021 was delayed by the COVID pandemic, its results were published about a year ago, and there hasn't been as much commentary and reflection this time on the REF as one might imagine. And a number of colleagues also commented that in the immediate aftermath of the REF results coming out, even on Twitter, that classic sort of site of self-promotion, there were very few academics who were unselfconsciously celebrating the results as they were coming out. There was much more of a sort of guarded response, I guess, to what was happening. And so it's interesting to think what that might be about. But whilst this sort of commentary on the REF seems to be more muted, there's still a sense that, you know, institutions are nonetheless continuing with their preparations of what the next one is going to be. And one proposal which is being floated is this idea that the research environment part of the REF submission is going to be devolved upwards to the university level. So there it will include the university's overall strategy, as well as how it's developed within units of assessment. Now it's interesting, and I will introduce the panel shortly, and I'm pleased that it includes people expert in the area of policy evaluation and also in research into innovation, because it's striking that companies in the private sector that are known for innovation within the digital field, for example, are seeming to adopt a distributed organization, similar to what universities had been like prior to audit mania, while universities seem to be adopting much more a centralized and bureaucratic model of old-style corporations. So this was just one thought that was inspired by Juan Pablo's excellent book, and which places a very large and agile cat amongst the pigeons. And here I'm thinking of us academics as those pigeons. It's not often that a book involving a quantitative analysis of citation data can be called an engaging and inspiring read. But it really is a page turner. It's written incredibly well and it's interesting, and I would recommend it to everybody here and to anybody really who's interested in the life of the mind, the way in which it's disciplined, and actually for those who are looking for the transgressions that Juan Pablo hopes may free us from some of the dictates of the disciplining processes that are happening. So without further ado then, I'll introduce the panel. I'll begin with the author of the book that we're going to be discussing here today. So we have Juan Pablo Pardo Guerra. He's an associate professor in sociology at the University of California, San Diego. He's also co-founder of the Computational Social Science Program there and associate director of the Latin American Studies Program. His research more broadly concerns markets and their location in contemporary societies, with an emphasis on finance, knowledge, and organizations, as we will hear more about shortly. Alongside Juan Pablo, we also have three eminent scholars who will offer further reflections on the themes arising from the analysis. In the order in which they'll speak, we have Sarah DeRuyck, Sam Friedman, and John Homewood. You can find out much more about all of these scholars on the LSE Sociology events page, and so I'm only going to give a very brief introduction to each here. Sarah DeRuyck is Professor in Science and Evaluation Studies and Scientific Director at the Center for Science and Technology Studies in Leiden. She specializes in social studies of research evaluation and has published widely on the relations between quality control mechanisms and knowledge production in different fields. Professor Sam Friedman is Professor of Sociology here at LSE, and I'm sure known to many of you. He's published widely on issues of class, culture, and social mobility, including the books The Class Ceiling, Why It Pays to Be Privileged, and is co-author of Social Class in the 21st Century, and also working on a new book looking at the historical development of the British elite. Professor John Homewood is Professor Emeritus in the School of Sociology and Social Policy at the University of Nottingham, and also Senior Researcher in the Center for Science, Technology, and Society Studies at the Institute for Philosophy at the Czech Academy of Sciences. He was co-founder of the Campaign for the Public University in 2010, and has also been President of the British Sociological Association. So with these brief introductions, I'll turn to each speaker, who has about 10 minutes each for their commentary, and then we'll return to Juan Pablo at the end as well for any responses to these initial comments. So Juan Pablo, over to you.
Great. So I'm going to go to the. Is this on? Yeah. Great. So thank you very much for the very kind introduction. I want to open my remarks by thanking the organizers, Fran, Rebecca, to Daniel, Lorison, for providing this space. I also, of course, want to thank the panelists, Gurminder, Sara, and John, and Sam for their generosity and for agreeing to serve as commentators for this session. And I also want to thank each and every one of you for taking an afternoon out in the final week of the term. So thank you very much for joining us for this conversation. Coming back to the place and community where the quantified scholar first came to life is both an occasion for talking about our presence and the collective challenges that we still face, but also remembering the pasts that we share, the friendships we made, the colleagues we encountered, and those we lost. My heart is really truly full. This is an incredible honor. Thank you very much for all of this. So the quantified scholar is an exploration of a culture that we all are too familiar with. The research assessments and evaluations that since the 1980s have embedded our academic labor. Combining computational methods, quantitative analyses, and conversations with scholars from across Britain, the book shows the organizational logics of research assessments and how these shifted the intellectual work and careers of social scientists in the United Kingdom over time. Anchored on specific disciplinary rationalities, these exercises discipline the academic field towards greater levels of organizational and epistemic homogeneity. Now, like other intellectual projects, the quantified scholar was a result of both serendipity and personal experience. As far as I recall, the idea for the book came just after I had read the impressive study by Michel Lamont, How Professors Think, as the department was going through the gearing up or the preparation for Ref 2014. Having read the work of Wendy Espeland and Michael Sauter on rankings in law schools, some years prior, the discussions around Ref strategy and planning for assessing for the assessment almost naturally triggered the idea of studying it as a ranking exercise that changed fields and configured knowledge. Now, while this book originated in 2012-13 conceptually, it needed some years to come into existence. Before I could dedicate any serious time to the project, I had to finish my first book on the invisible work that goes into automating stock exchanges. More fatefully, of course, working on this project had to contend with the commotion of moving to a different institution, the University of California, San Diego, a shift that was generative but decidedly disruptive. Some of the disruption was tied indeed to the same kind of disciplinary pressures that are behind the patterns that I explore in the book. Moving institutions and changing disciplinary communities meant having to rethink how I would operationalize this project, make it actually happen and legible to the new members or the members of my new community of peers. Critically, this move involved having to engage much more clearly and directly with quantitative traditions of social research that seemed not to fit with my background in science and technology studies. You see, people in STS, like I sometimes define myself as, tend to see numbers with suspicion, to distrust complicated models that act as black boxes, generating claims disguised as if revelations from an oracle. Now, of course, not all American sociologists are quantitative. Many of my colleagues, and indeed of the scholars whose work I truly admire, have built impressive careers standing solidly in qualitative and historical traditions. But as I created new roots in a new land, it was difficult to escape the fact that a pretty picture made with lots of data beckons a larger market. The book had to wait for me to learn how to produce those pretty pictures, how to reduce complex worlds to numbers, how to tell stories with maximum likelihood estimation. Despite or perhaps precisely because of this methodological shift, writing the quantitative scholar became an intensely reflexive experience. having to align findings at the macro and micro levels, word embeddings with interviews, and to think about the numerous inferences made on the basis of the computational corpus that is behind those images, ended up challenging some of the key assumptions I had going into the project. To an extent, the initial impetus for the project echoed some of the grievances that many of us had and might still have about the ref. But as I stitched together the evidence, the findings that emerged, at least for me, standing in 2013, were relatively unexpected. Now, the first finding of the book that is consistent with our shared accounts of the research evaluations is that these mechanisms have made the British social sciences less diverse both in organizational and epistemic terms. Models of labor mobility for British anthropologists, economists, scholars in politics, and sociologists show that across evaluation periods, academics sorted themselves across institutions, slowly changing the culture and character of units and departments. The patterns are quite clear. Scholars in more atypical departments, those that were far from the discipline's norm, were more likely to move, as were those whose work replicated that of their peers. Those not evaluated in their disciplinary categories in the fields that they are actually publishing in were similarly more likely to change employers between evaluations. Departments became more generalist over time, mimicking their thematic composition and the way concepts were used within them. Assessment after assessment, exercise after exercise, the structure of British social science changed. I was decidedly nervous when the book came out. I was never entirely sure if these statements about homogeneity and so forth built atop these complicated models were as strong as I would have liked them to be. It's been comforting, however, that since the publication of The Quantified Scholar, other researchers have identified similar processes. Most recently, a paper written by Michael Park, Aaron Leahy, and Russell Funk shows that patents and research papers across the world have become less creative and less disruptive over time. This is echoed by the work of an esteemed colleague from Arizona State University, Charlie Gomez, who documents an increase in the degree of quote-unquote paradigmaticness of knowledge over the last half century. Related patterns are also documented in the work of Moki Groen-Shu and her colleagues, who shows in a superb new paper in Research Policy that articles published just before the exercise's deadline receive, on average, fewer citations than those published after. All these studies speak to the kind of institutional dynamics that are characteristic of the research evaluations: bottlenecks and gatekeepers in publications, a focus on metrics and productivity, and disciplinary logics in career evaluations. Now, the second and much more surprising finding was the mechanism that fueled this homogeneity. In my conversations with scholars across institutions, it became clear that the force of the evaluation was experienced mostly within the contested process of internal assessments that institutions use to plan for ref, the kind of mock assessments that other forms of surveillance that we use to calibrate submissions. These relatively simple administrative devices, originally meant to provide greater certainty to institutions about their possible results, became instruments of personnel management. Imperfect scales upon which the value of scholars, both monetary and epistemic, is approximated in the absence of competition. On the ground pragmatic devices, these academic valorimeters, if we want to call them that, are what seems to affect most directly the experience of scholars, leading to the kind of environments that motivates some to drop out of academia entirely or to at least change jobs. It is then not the evaluation in itself which is responsible for creating homogeneity or disciplining our knowledge, but rather how we make it meaningful both in our individual practices as scholars and academics, and in how we are exposed to it as workers within an organized workplace. In some institutions, indeed, REF is felt less than in others. For example, with status serving as the key moderator of how strongly REF is felt. Indeed, however much we might dislike the research evaluation framework, we nevertheless comply with its logics of excellence and merit because they also seem to reflect the kind of academia that many of us are trained into and assume possible. We see excellence as something that, albeit imperfectly, reflects the notions of devotion, competence, and dedication to one's work that many academics do hold dear to their minds and hearts. The power of the evaluations, then, is not in the stars or numbers themselves, not in the panels, nor even in the monetary disbursements of quality-related funding, but in how we play their game in the name of excellence, in a form of excellence that we collectively perform. This second and decidedly more polemic point hasn't been as well received as the one about convergence and homogenization, and it's been talked about a bit less. The first time I presented this book in the UK a year ago to a small but wonderful audience, it generated strong reactions. The claim that we are implicated in some ways in maintaining the logics of REF was considered a failure to recognize the power exercised by administrators in our profession. Where was neoliberalism in this account? Where is the power of the managers? Without them, our profession would surely be freer, better, less stressful, and fairer for everyone, would it not? Now, managers, administrators, and politicians certainly play a central role in this story. They continuously conjure, after all, the specter of austerity, even in the most affluent time in the history of humanity, creating scarcity where there is none. Of this, they are fully and entirely responsible. But to say that we, as academics, have no role in the reproduction of these dynamics of homogeneity would be to miss an important point or part of the process, and one that we could actually change and tackle. Indeed, to peg the force of the evaluation on others' hands is to represent our profession as powerless, feeble, innocent, a depiction that is simply inconsistent with our everyday practice and historical experience. We are, after all, complicit in making numbers powerful. We decide who to cite, and in doing so, reproduce or not the gendered, racialized, and colonial biases of our shared knowledge. We actively create our Google Scholar websites, celebrating sometimes occasions when we pass important thresholds. Yay, my 100th citation, for example. And in doing so, reify numbers as indicators of something. We actively edit and review our colleagues' work, deciding if it is published or not, if they are promoted or not. We include the phrase, this paper will be impactful, in our peer review evaluations. We speak in the language of prestige, referring to others in terms of the journals where they published and the prizes that they obtained, rather than other critical aspects of their professional lives. Ooh, did you see who published in AJS? That kind of thing. We actively plant the seeds of these politics of prestige among our undergraduate and graduate students by populating our syllabi with canons that are all too often indistinguishable from hierarchies of status. And we do so without any malicious intent. We do so because that is the very culture that we have been trained into. And that is a culture that makes numbers, rankings, and evaluations powerful because of how they reflect these principles of some shared vocation. We are not powerless, however. Even numbers, rankings, and ratings, those devices so often used to manage our minds, can be harnessed to produce potentially better worlds. Their logics can be inverted to quantify those who have quantified us with extreme glee. So an example is that in late summer of 2022, I decided to engage in an exercise of what we could call reverse quantification. With some spare time on a weekend, I set up a website called rateyourcampusadmin.com that allows academics and staff to score, rank, and review senior university administrators for their performance. Just as we are ranked, why not rank those who exercise positions of power in our workplace? Interest in the website was impressive, much larger than any interest in the Quantified Scholar will ever have. By the end of the first week of operation, rateyourcampusadmin.com had more than 3,000 registered users. Needless to say, the website's success was also part of its failure. Having a full-time job means that this site quickly ran into a state of disrepair. But the experiment was promising, creating hope among academics that maybe they could regain voice in their sector. RateYourCampusAdmin.com was more of experimental satire than purposeful intervention, a better and more concrete example of how we can repurpose the evaluations or evaluations in general is found in discussions about the impacts of the pandemic over academic careers. As I am sure is happening elsewhere in other institutions, ours in San Diego is still discussing how to consider pandemic disruptions in our colleagues' evaluations for hiring, promotion, and merit review. And rather than treating this as an exceptional moment, we are collectively making this an opportunity to design and introduce long-term policies of achievement relative to opportunities that will recognize the effects of different life experiences on the work of academics. Backed by metrics that are constantly reviewed and reweighed, these policies seek to close the recognition gaps and the productivity and evaluation gaps between academics and in doing so, perhaps take us in a better direction. Now, these are admittedly small steps at a time when we need tremendous leaps. And I would like to be able to offer you a bullet point PowerPoint with what the next steps should be. In his recently published review of the Quantified Scholar, however, Emmanuel Kosinski notes a choice that I made when writing the book, avoiding specific recommendations or practical suggestions for addressing the challenges posed by increasing quantification of academic research. As he notes, this may frustrate or disappoint some readers. You here might be among these. So there will be no PowerPoint with what to do. But just like knowledge is the result of many minds, finding solutions to our problems must involve many committed and active hands on the ground. And this is really the real takeaway, the central takeaway of the book. We are living an urgent, uncertain moment for our knowledges and societies. To take this as a moment of purification, of trying to recreate an academia that probably never was, would be to not recognize this urgency. This is rather a time to be bold and rethink the purpose and standing of our craft. What do we intend to achieve with the knowledge that we produce and communicate? How will this knowledge be read in 3-4 decades, when much of the world we live in and take for granted today has been irreparably lost? There is no better time for reflexivity and introspection than now. And that is why I cannot offer prescriptions, but only calls for deliberation. At the end, the challenge and message of the Quantified Scholar is that, to rekindle solidarity at what is, in many ways, the end of the world. Some people say that I use this phrase too much, and they might be right, but in many ways we are, if not at the end of the world, at the very least at the end of a world. We here are the fortunate. It was the end of the world for millions who died during the pandemic. It is the end of the world for the countless objects and relations of our ecologies that have disappeared and will never return. It is the end of the world for the millions who are migrating forced by violence and insecurity in their homelands, for those that will be displaced by the effects of climate change, for those who are caught in the worst end of rising inequality. Knowledge that does not recognize these conditions, that does not see these as the fundamental setting where our profession is taking place, is puzzle solving on a sinking ship. So let's make knowledge of ourselves as academics and of the world the basis of solidarity. Let us recognize in our experiences as scholars and as citizens that in these uncertain times, that there are better ways of doing things, some of which are actually under our control. Let's keep striking and fighting for fairness in employment, and let us also use that same spirit in our peer reviews, our assessments, our staff meetings, our syllabi, and our framing of the worth of others. This is not an exercise in optimization. It is not an incitement to rank things yet again, but with more data or in better ways. It is instead an invitation to rethink the connected lives that we build in our profession and the debt that we have towards those around us and those yet to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that. Sarah, I pass over.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you, Fran and Rebecca, also, and Daniel and Gaminder, and especially JP for your wonderful, wonderful book. I think I'm relatively up to speed with the literature on quantification in academia. And this is really, this book stands out and for a number of reasons.
Maybe.
Yeah, a little bit like this. Is this better? Okay. I was just starting the praise, so we can slide into that. I think it stands out for a couple of reasons, and I'll come to some well, it's not really a critical remark, but maybe remarks for the discussion after that. For one, because you bring together a really large body of literatures that aren't often brought together in this particular space. SCS, you mentioned, sociology, anthropology, history, philosophy of science. It's a very interesting interdisciplinary endeavor in this area. It's also what the topic calls for, but what actually rarely happens, so that's great. Another aspect of the book I quite enjoyed is how you combine, and it was already quite visible, different methodologies from longitudinal data to statistical computational models from interviews or histories, and that you integrate those findings also in an innovative way, and not only enriching our understanding of the interactions between evaluation and quantification on the one hand, but also the interactions with the substance of scholarly work and the epistemic directionality of the work as a result of quantification on the other hand. And that's already quite an achievement. It makes it all the more remarkable, and then now getting to know you a bit better in person, meeting in person for the first time. So you also decided to bring in your own lived experience and made these experiences analytically relevant. And you did that by making explicit how these experiences informed the project, and the questions and the concerns, and that is really something that happens really rarely, and perhaps that is paradoxically something that has to do with the ways in which power and prestige are distributed in academia, and also how positivist philosophies of science have engulfed or also are thinking about scientific objectivity. What I also really applaud is how you use both the experiences and your training and the results from your analyses in writing a call to action, really a moral appeal to the academic community. You did that here too. I really appreciate that. And it's also a claim because we're also partly implicated. We're partly responsible. This is a call to push back on quantification in the academic workplace and to practice more reflexive solidarity and use our power to stop reproducing inequalities and precarities in institutions by unreflexively adopting performance criteria and evaluation standards. I also have a few points for discussion, we've talked about this before. I think one is about the role of the sciences and the social sciences in the quantification of academia, which I think you do mention, but I also think you perhaps underplay that a little bit. I'll get back to that. And the second point is about your interview material, which gives, on the one hand, it gives great texture to the computational and the statistical analyses, but I also wondered if they, in a sense, also don't do you a little bit of a disservice sometimes. So first, the point about the underplaying of the role of the social sciences and the sciences in the quantification of academia. I must say, maybe from the beginning, that I'm a director of a Center for Science and Technology Studies that also does a lot of scientometrics and also produces a lot of the metrics, and does that, I think, in a relatively reflexive way. So I've thought a lot about how bibliometrics and scientometrics came about as a field, and you also have thought carefully about that. And you do mention how bibliometrics and scientometrics, how it shifted from being concerned with the structure of scientific disciplines to how it now also is quite established as a field and frequently used to determine the worth of scholarly contributions to disciplines. And I think you're right, this is an active element of being a so-called regulatory social science, in the sense that much of bibliometrics and scientometrics informs policy instruments, and in turn that these policy instruments are shaped by regulatory processes. So it's social scientists that produced university rankings already 1.5 centuries ago. It's also the social science of bibliometrics and scientometrics that helped quantify academia. And I guess to me that would also imply that it's a social science that should step up. I will return to that point a bit later. But I also wanted to come to that point about the interview material, and especially the work it does for you in the later chapters of the book. And that has to do with the following. I think considering what we know about the real-world effects of evaluation on knowledge production, I find it very fascinating that an overwhelming majority of your interviewees don't see or don't want to see how evaluation influences their practices and interests or their epistemic research trajectories. And only in tangential conversations did they seem to make the connection by way of organizational responses or reactivity in the hiring and promotion practices. Existing research you've also cited has, I think, already shown that evaluation systems have performative effects, won't be a surprise maybe in this audience, that they're perhaps even more invasive and consequential than you can now acknowledge when you look at your interview material. So on the one hand, your findings from the interviews are informative, do the job of delivering us this new information. On the other hand, I immediately thought that there must be more to it than they're saying, willing to say, or can say, because they're really unaware, or because they won't, I don't know, because they're uncomfortable addressing the implicatedness in this indicator game. So are these socially desirable answers? Are they telling of how scholars attach identity to independence, to academic freedom? Should we worry about the fact that they don't really realize the interactions between assessment and knowledge production? So I really wonder, were you surprised about these responses? Did the conversations you have have the effects that they in the conversation started to think about this and see it for the first time? That would be a bit surprising. And the final thing I would like to maybe throw at you is when we look at the current research evaluation landscape beyond the UK, I see two trends, and one is a clear pushback on quantification. You, for instance, see that in the European area with COARA, with the Agreement on Research Assessment. DORA, well, it has a history. A movement that I think you leave untouched, perhaps even hold for impossible or unfeasible in your book, in this particular context, maybe. And the second trend I see, in a sense, is the complete opposite. That's an intensification of the presence of quantitative information about research in the evaluation system. There was mention of AI, machine learning, an increasing role for data analytics, increasingly commercialized roles for data analytics and data providers, making use, ironically, of the same computational methods that you are using in your research. And I'm bringing these trends up because of your really beautiful call for solidarity toward the end of the book, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. It's also a guiding force for me personally in my own role as scientific director of that kind of complicated institution. But part of me thinks that we should go even a bit further in the sense that we should not take quantification as something we can't change, we have no agency over. I'm happy that you were doing that experiment over the weekend. But I think sometimes you imply a little bit like that, or at least in my reading of that of your book. I think we should do more, because, as you know, also I think pointed out, social scientists are themselves partly responsible, because they co-designed the indicators and the rankings, and because we do a lot of identity work with these indicators. And I'd love to hear your view on that. The other thing, so this increasing trend toward research intelligence that we see, a growing need for quantitative information about research, the rise of these huge machineries of data analytics services and mainly commercial actors that come into this space with services with often very black boxed methods. And considering what your interviewees then shared, I am extremely worried that individual researchers might not notice how data analytics are already, to a large extent, shaping their work, what we read, which lines we underline, etc., but also how these things are made to count in assessments. And I think this will increasingly insert itself in the ranking and rating practices of REF panels as well. So I very much agree that we would need to rethink our vocation and practice solidarity, but I also think we're increasingly facing an entirely different beast. And I hope that that academics know what they're up against, and I would encourage you to write your next book on that that dynamic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So normally when you get asked to speak in an event like this, it's because, like Sarah, you at least vaguely have the kind of expertise that qualifies you to pass judgment or say something intelligent. I'm afraid in my case that isn't really true. So why was I asked to comment? I'm not really sure, to be honest, and actually when I started thinking about it properly, I started to get a bit paranoid. Maybe my colleagues thought, who's the most egotistical, metric-obsessed person in the department? Oh, yes, Sam. Let's get him to talk. Well, whether my paranoia is well-founded or not, what I realized when reading JP's excellent book is that actually many of its themes did land personally, however much it pains me to acknowledge. Specifically, many of the processes JP describes directly apply, I think, in terms of both my own problematic sensitivity to metrics and how quickly I reach for them in making assessments of others. I think in myself at least, I think they speak to a sort of recognition anxiety and provide an immediate and fairly privatized tool that allows me to fairly instantaneously get some kind of answer, even if deeply flawed, to the question that plagues me and perhaps others, right? Is my work any good? Does anybody actually care? I also think metrics, I realize, reading the book, have also, in the way that JP described, shaped my own epistemic sorting. So when I got to LSE, for example, it was made clear to me that my progression was somewhat dependent on broadening my intellectual interests. My PhD was about comedy, so pretty niche. And a move towards publishing in the big generalist American journals. Now, while I can tell myself a particular story about my own agency in that, or how it improved the rigor, scope, originality of the work, it's also true that aiming for these journals also probably orientated me towards more mainstream or safer sociological topic areas, which frankly I felt I would have a better chance of getting into those journals with. So this kind of self-indulgent intro is mainly to say I read JP's excellent book and it continually resonated in ways I think that good sociology should. I felt somewhat cathartic in its careful, critical articulation of processes that I've struggled with about how academia and academic hierarchies operate. I think it also must be said, and others have already said, that it's a beautifully written and engaging book, has an impressive mixed methods design, and there are some really startling findings, particularly from JP's rich and highly original computational analysis. British sociology, I learnt, for example, has the same degree of structural homogeneity that economics had in the mid-1980s, for example, which I think is pretty telling in terms of the argument about the kind of creeping homogeneity of the discipline. But for the sake of debate, I wanted to aim three provocations at JP to get his thoughts on a few things that struck me as I read. So the first one is this. Daniel Laurison and I wrote a book called The Class Ceiling a few years ago, where we found out, among other things, that UK academia is both strongly skewed towards those from privileged class backgrounds, and that once in the profession, academics from working class backgrounds face a significant class pay gap compared to their more privileged peers. Now, when we looked at the drivers of this class pay gap, although we didn't specifically look at academia, I think much of what we found probably applies, possibly applies. One of the key things there was that in professions where there is this kind of heightened ambiguity of knowledge, essentially where it's particularly unclear and contested what merit looks like, not only do those from privileged backgrounds tend to excel because their embodied cultural capital tends to be misread as merit, but those from working class backgrounds also tend to sort out or sort away from those types of jobs, often citing to us in interviews that they did so essentially because the rules of the game were particularly opaque, that they didn't really understand what they needed to do in terms of demonstrating competence in those jobs, how to get a job, how to get promoted. Instead, they often opted for more technical or operational routes or jobs where, you know, what they would tell us is, you know, it's much clearer what I need to do to get ahead. And often, I suppose, here's the thing, in ways where performance or competence was easily quantified, right? That was often cited into clear and transparent metrics. Now, I'm fully aware that the metrics we use in academia, particularly citation patterns, tend to accentuate, not ameliorate inequality, particularly gendered and racialized inequality. But my provocation is that if, and I know it's a big if, some of the quantification processes that you're describing have contributed to making UK academia less opaque, more transparent to certain disadvantaged groups, such as those from working class backgrounds, how do we weigh this inequality ameliorating effect or dimension against the kind of pernicious intellectual effects of quantification you cite in the book? And perhaps to be even more provocative, do you think that one reason why academics like you and I, who both have academic parents, are so attracted to the arguments that you make in the book is because we've always had a kind of instinctive and somewhat privileged sense of how to navigate academia without the need of heuristics like metrics to guide or direct us? My second provocation is a more basic empirical one. Without knowledge of what went before these research evaluations in terms of epistemic and intellectual diversity, how can we be sure that it's the research evaluations themselves that are driving the epistemic sorting document? Are our evaluations really the mechanism, in other words? And it was just, I just had a very rudimentary thought in this front, which is if we think about British sociology as an example, and I'm certainly not an expert on this, could it be, for example, that some of the big rancorous theoretical debates of the 1970s and 80s, where Marxist and functionalist schools in particular kind of lost prominence, might that be another driver of the fact that in following decades there's been a slowly homogenizing creep in the discipline? Finally, a question about elites, which is a subject on my mind. I'm working on this myself at the moment. So in the UK social sciences, the traditional marker of reaching the academic elite of really leading the field is election to the British Academy. Kaminda is part of the British Academy. But I wonder, do you think, I'm interested in others thought, whether quantification has meaningfully encroached on how these kind of elite gatekeeping decisions are made. Obviously, this is an empirical question, but my instinct would be no, that actually the way people gain entry to these very elite symbolic positions is through their peers' reputational assessments of some of the things in a way that you say are receding in importance. That it's really about demonstrating originality, creativity, of shaking up or being seen to shake up the discipline intellectually and epistemically. Of course, I might be wrong, but if that is the case, what implications might that have for your argument? I'm not even sure I know, but if those at the top of the prestige hierarchy are still ultimately rewarded for innovation, does that not continue to act as an important signal that guides the decisions of those below them when seeking to sort of progress in the discipline? I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot for that, John. A lot that's very provocative there. We can have lots of conversations, but I'll pass over to John first.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, it's a pleasure to be invited to talk about Juan Pablo's book. I mean, I've been interested in the topic for quite a while, and particularly also in the context of trying to challenge some aspects of it. So a lot of it resonated with me. There's been a lot of interest in the RAE or REF, I'll refer to it as REF from now on, as a system of research evaluation, the validity of its measures, its consequences for academic well-being, etc. But very little has been written of its impact on the structure and practices of academic disciplines, notwithstanding that the REF has been a feature of UK academic life for over 30 years. This is what makes it, I think, such a powerful object for research for Juan Pablo. And as he sets it out, I think it becomes very clear that the REF is a co-produced and self-legitimating system of evaluation. It's reproduced through the active participation of those subject to its devices. It's both highly centralized, nationally through UKRI, and within each university and its research governance system. But it's also dispersed through subject panels, departments and units of assessment, and in the practices of individual academics. That's what's so powerful about Juan Pablo's presentation, that each of those levels involves multiple forms of buy-in, and that also includes professional associations. And I put that as a, you know, shriek question mark there about the nature of organizing opposition, because our professional associations are also bound up in the processes of the REF. Notwithstanding any disciplinary self-understanding of scholarship and research as a form of critical engagement, one consequence of the REF as co-produced has been the co-production of resistance to criticism of it and of how it has shaped research on the part of those most actively caught up in it. You might think that this is odd, given Govinda's statement at the beginning of how, as academics, we love to sort of engage with the trials and tribulations of academic life, but mostly criticism of the REF has been individualized in terms of academic well-being, or if expressed in relation to collective aspects, it's in the REF's contribution to increased managerialism within the university, alongside, of course, other audit mechanisms. Yet that managerialism is itself co-produced, and that's what we need to confront. The unwillingness, and I sense that in the British reaction to Juan Pablo's book, there is an unwillingness to countenance a critical sociology of science applied to the REF. And this is, you know, quite extraordinary. But we should understand that it's a constitutive feature of the REF itself, and particularly over time, critical engagement with it has declined. The REF determines the distribution of QR funding. In addition, position in a rank order of outcomes has become increasingly important alongside the introduction of student fees as a means of recruiting students in the marketplace. And the REF panels, of course, have to be populated in order to produce these effects, and we're asked to be grateful to those of our colleagues who've taken on this mantle. All these aspects secure compliance, or at least pragmatic acceptance, of the REF. But the REF is also self-referential as well as self-reproducing. Each REF exercise shows an increase in the international significance of the submissions to it. This was so in the most recent exercise, despite there being a 46% increase in full-time equivalent staff submitted to the REF, this is a consequence of the Stern reforms. Sociology as a discipline, as a unit assessment, had a 56.8% increase in staff submitted. And yet, 2021 over 2014 showed a significant increase in international significance, as measured by four-star research. And what we're encouraged to consider is that seeming differences in judgments across panels, not all panels make the same, have the same distribution, and the distributions over time of the different panels change. And we're encouraged to think that these differences reflect real differences in quality. After all, and here they're produced, they're not produced by a metric exercise. The exercise of peer review in the panels generates a metric, but it is not itself the operation of data analytics straightforwardly. So the rectification over time of apparent anomalies, or what I would regard as anomalies, is attributed to a real improvement across the REF cycle. So the increase of four-star outputs in sociology from a relatively low level of 21.1% in 2014, declared then to be a real judgment about the quality of sociology, has gone up to 31.8% in 2021. And that's explained by an improvement in the research environments of the units of assessment within the submission, if you look at the documentation has produced. So what I'd say, so in a sense, if you've got improving scores and it's a self-referential system, what's there not to like about it? We're getting better and better in so many different ways. So the other thing that Juan Padua shows is how the quantification of scholarly activity has produced what we might call an iron cage of research organization. He hopes the bars are malleable, or that at least that we can prise them apart. And he poses the question, can it be mitigated by the self-organization of scholars determined to act in a collegial manner? Indeed, he directs us towards this as an objective, including the possibility of a new transformative and transgressive practice. But the problem is that the general consequence of the REF has been to produce a series of what Andrew Abbott applied to other topics, calls self-similar structures. That is, there are self-similar structures of research practice and management across all universities. At different times, reforms have been suggested to modify its character and make it less of a constraint upon academics. The Stern Review was the last, but that seems only to have reinforced the negative characteristic. This becomes clear when we consider the consequence of REF 2021, which accentuated tendencies evident in Juan Pablo's analysis of developments up to REF 2014. And of course, the qualitative interviews in the book are reflecting upon changes within of how the mock exercises have been developed after 2014. Now, the book organizes citation data to assess the implications of the REF evaluation process up to REF 2014. But as I've suggested, the qualitative interviews are conducted in relation to preparations for REF 2021. In that sense, they show that the Stern reforms the requirement that all staff with research as part of their contract should be included in a submission, something which might have been expected to depress scores, with the requirement that each individual should have at least one rather than four items, something that should have relaxed the pressure upon academics, did not loosen the turn of the ref audit screw. It actually accentuated and produced this, to me, inexplicable uptick in four-star and three-star research. Moreover, the interview showed that there was significant buy-in into the logic of the ref down to departmental level in the form of the locally self-similar structure, that is, on the part of research directors and ref leads, and in terms of the incorporation of ref criteria into promotion criteria. Of course, this was not straightforward for all disciplines, but of the four examined, economics, sociology, politics, and anthropology, economists were most aligned with the assumptions of the ref, and sociologists and anthropologists least aligned. But one of the most striking findings is the book shows a convergence of all disciplines on a pattern best exemplified by economics at an earlier point in its disciplinary development. I suggest it wasn't particularly a disciplinary development of economics, and it probably, in relation to the point Sam was making, pre-existed the ref as a feature of economics. Certainly, citation data from the States in the 70s and 80s showed that. But we, as a consequence of the ref, are becoming most like economics, more similar in terms of the representation of the discipline through a set of common fields and topics which come to be stable across ref cycles. And I think what the book admirably shows is that this is a product of the ref as each cycle is planned for by universities through their research strategies and ref readiness exercises, and also by individuals in terms of their career movements and career planning. So it's not something imposed upon individuals, or if it's imposed, it's a structure within which individuals have readily learned how they should orient their careers. Paradoxically, as the international standing of the disciplines increases, so innovation is reduced and becomes a matter of central planning within universities. So I pose here, this is a sort of, what would it be called, a rhetorical empirical question, if there can be such a thing. Is there a UK university without a centrally defined research strategy? Response, no. They're all set out to identify research excellence and innovative work on global challenges. There's not a single one that isn't about global challenges, and nearly all of them promote the same challenges: environment, health, sustainability, security, justice. That's the centrally organized research. And that convergence is also reinforced by the impact agenda, which directs research towards co-production with users. So we've got a whole series of co-constructed practices going on. I think, I mean, because the impact agenda was first introduced in 2014, it's difficult for it to be evaluated in this, in the context of what Juan Pablo was doing, but I think it will be seen to be really significant. In early discussions of research, the issue of impact used to be conceptualized in terms of what was called mode one disciplinary knowledge and mode two applied interdisciplinary. But the ref, and particularly the impact agenda, undercuts that distinction. The ref generates a lot of discussion of the problem of interdisciplinarity and how it is to be evaluated. But this becomes interdisciplinarity across subpanels. But main panel C, the one that most of us here would be in, includes business studies as well as economics. and social work and social policy as well as sociology? Is business studies a discipline? Is social policy a discipline? Is sport, leisure and tourism a discipline? And if they're not, and if there's something different about disciplines and applied areas of application, are the REF criteria and weightings appropriately applied equally in the different subpanels? So that argument about the equity of criteria becomes a means of reproducing conformity. And I'd say, so this is my only criticism of the book, it's not really a criticism. And it's a pity that you chose four disciplines rather than, say, two disciplines and two applied areas, so that we could, because I would have liked to see the relation between economics and business studies and so on. But I think what you also show, and it maybe goes some way to answering Sam's question, is that the disciplinary consolidation of sociology favors male academics over female and white over ethnic minority academics. If all departments are moving to a similar spread of topic fields, might this be a factor in the failure to overcome inequalities in recruitment and promotion? For example, are women and ethnic minorities more concentrated in terms of topic fields? And how might we compare economics and sociology in this regard, where the former discipline is more internationalized and at the same time more male dominated? And finally, because you're addressing how the formal processes of the REF are accentuated by mock exercises within institutions, it looks as if this is exacerbated by changed methodology for REF 2021. And this is where data analytics comes in. Not at the REF, where academics maybe saw off the metric tide. The metric tide is taking place within university level processes. At the University of Nottingham, where I was, there was a dashboard. And that dashboard had all your citation information and so on. And we were considerably reassured as academics to be told this would not be available to your colleagues, but only to university managers. And my response was, thank God for that. What if my colleagues were to actually understand and see my work? That would be a nightmare. So I think that I fully agree and endorse your call for more compassion and solidarity in our self-organization of the REF. And I think it was apt to draw on experiences during COVID to think of that. But the question I will put, have we missed that post-COVID moment, and that actually the reproduction of business as usual has gone apace within certainly UK universities?
Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you very much for the comments, the questions, the provocating insights. So I think I'm going to try to articulate the responses around the questions that Sarah raised. And the first one is on metrics, anti-metrics, and what they are good for, if they're good for anything. And they have to do with the issue of transparency, of course. So the problem with being anti-metrics, with thinking about this counterfactual world where we don't have citations and we don't have all the sort of quantified mechanisms for assessing differences in productivity, in scholarship, et cetera, between different academics, is that you can quickly see that world being very, very unequal. Because indeed, metrics do perform a job in the sense that they make transparent differences across individuals. And those can be differences that then become the basis for example, asking for equity between men and women, between different groups, that have been defined in terms of unequal relations throughout the last sort of history of everything. So I think metrics do have that role to play. The problem is, of course, when the metrics become, of course, what you are playing for, which is really the one of the issues, and when they become the only or the most prominent source of value. So when they become reified in dashboards, for instance, that management can use without expertise in the particular discipline to decide on who remains, who gets a promotion, who gets a raise, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that that's the moment, or that's the sort of, the threshold of metrics becoming toxic elements within our workplace. But again, the absence of metrics, and those people who fight against metrics are forgetting the fact that they can be used to highlight differences and inequalities in the system that, because they are so invisible, require some way of observing them, of documenting them. Again, if we don't count things, we don't know if people are paying enough taxes, we don't know if we need more services of a certain type, if the resources are properly allocated. So again, I think that that is a key theme that comes across this. And there might be a need to expand the kind of things we quantify. That's something that comes across these discussions of achievement relative to opportunity, in the sense that we don't quantify how many hours people spend taking care of their kids or their parents or of a loved one, which are things that ultimately affect the way people produce in the field, and that can be taken into account, can be accounted in how we value and reward individuals in academia. So counting those things, counting care, and I know it sounds a little bit fluffy and, oh, that sounds super hippie, but counting things that we tend to see as incommensurable or would be something that might actually provide us a basis for fighting for rights that are right now not respected necessarily by our employers. So it's a difficult thing to balance, because on the one hand, we have the sort of logics of using metrics as these forms of disciplining and punishment. And at the other, on the other hand, we have metrics being used as sources of transparency within organizations and fields. And it depends in many ways on who is doing the counting. So Sarah mentions all these, this proliferation of new kinds of metrics. But when the metric is owned by Elsevier, then you should really be wary of what that metric is actually doing. If the metric is something that is proposed by a sort of collection of faculty members or academic staff, it might not be great, because I'm not saying that academics are pure of hearts and minds, but it might be less problematic than the one you're getting off the publishers who have clicks and revenue as their objectives, in a sense. So I think that knowing what metrics are doing, where they come from, how they can be used, and fighting for the inclusion of particular kinds of metrics would be important and would be critical. And that's part of the collective work that I think we need to do. The other part, or the other question, is on the interviews, and I completely agree. I was really surprised that people didn't bring up the ref as something that changed what they were doing. But I think that that also comes from this self-similarity, in a sense, that we've fallen into, and also the idea that our work is something that comes out of our efforts and our mind, and might be shaped by what we read and our preferences, but that is it. And the fact that we are not more reflexive about why we wrote that article and why we wrote that book and why we decided to cite those people and not others, because that opening that box is very complicated, explains, I think, some of the reticence of people to admit that they're shaped by these evaluations. But we know that people are shaped by these evaluations. We know that, for example, there's wonderful studies on how in elite universities in the US, the kinds of thing that people publish are less constrained to disciplines because they are in these elite places, so they can just publish books if they want to. They don't need to show productivity to the organization. And we know that in the middle, where most of the discipline actually happens on an everyday basis in terms of both teaching and research, because of its volume and because of where it's positioned, they do feel distressed because they have to show that they published in certain places. And I think that that is really central to the logic of these interviews, or why the interviews weren't showing this, because people don't want to say. Academics don't want to say, well, I published this because I was told to do so by the ref, because then we just become workers in a factory, and we don't want to be that, even though we sort of are. And that's fine, because workers organize. So I think that that is also part of the issue. And of course, knowing more about the way metrics affect our work, affect our careers, our decisions on where to go and where not to go, what to read and not what to read, is important for academics as sort of basic literacy, in a sense, so that they understand what the possibilities of action are. And things like Santometrics are important because of that, because they have revealed, through those studies, patterns that we don't think of. And we never take the time to examine at all. So I think that is using social sciences to maybe unpack or undo some of the damages that social sciences did to themselves. So that is, I think, of course, very critical. And there's another rule. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's just because I'm conscious of time, sorry. And I'd really like to give the people here an opportunity to sort of at least pose some questions, which we may not be able to respond to. So there's a reception after this where we can also continue some of the discussions. I mean, there was so much in each of these that it would take a long time to respond to all of these points. But I just want to see if there is anybody within the audience who'd like to pose some questions to Juan Pablo particularly. There's one down at the front here, please, and then one at the back. Oh, just to the side. Could you introduce yourself? And
thank you. Can you hear me? Claire Moon in sociology at LSE. And I just wanted to ask you a bit more about your understanding of our collective failure to resist. Because as social scientists, sociologists in particular, we're probably best equipped to see through the politics and the implications of these kinds of exercises. And I have found it utterly mystifying that we've been almost abjectly compliant with these exercises over, you know, many years now. And I've really tried to understand it, and I think there is something that really comes back to Sam's point about class, which is about the sort of class ecology of academic life, and not least its more elite composition and its desire to reproduce itself. So there's no accident that it's, you know, most working class academics from working class backgrounds are in post 92 universities in the UK. And so there's more of an attachment, and you use these words, vocation, devotion, prestige. These are not the kinds of ideas that float around working class forms of work. So that's one thing, which is about class reproduction. And the second thing is probably a more practical dimension, which is to do with workloads. And many people complain, you know, that we simply lack the time and energy to engage in any concrete resistance. I don't know if this is just a, you know, is this actually just covers up the first problem I pointed out, or whether this is actually real, and whether these things were borne out in the interviews that you did and the work that you did.
There was a question there as well. We'll collect a few, if that's right.
Thank you. Pat McGovern in sociology was also in the room when JP starts his book with, and in subsequent meetings outside the room, which you didn't attend, but anyway. I think you underestimate the power of fear in academia. I think somewhere we know that we've spent many years in university and we don't want to give up on an academic career. And so we feel obliged to play the game, whether that's for promotion or ref or anything else, because we know that there's not too many other places we can get employed. So that would be my basic mechanism. The other comment I have is, in a small way, I did a content analysis in the sociology of work in journal articles, 1990 to 2015. And I was struck by the conformity, almost formula written, and as part of that, a lack of theoretical innovation. I know that wasn't something that was in your work directly, but I'd be interested in your thoughts about conformity in terms of the kind of research we do and what we produce.
Okay, anybody else? There's one here and then one at the back. Maybe if you take that one there first. Just if you raise your hand again. Yeah.
Thanks, JP, and thank you for the other speakers. I have a question. I'm actually sitting next to Tin El-Kadi, and we did some interviews about kind of incentives of where to publish in African universities. And it was kind of reassuring. I was in Ghana for a conference, and I interviewed quite a few academics in the University of Ghana. And among social scientists, there was a kind of valuing of publishing in local Ghanaian journals, but in the economics department, there was a very much a sort of need to publish in international journals. And when I think about the way that African politics is studied, particularly in the United States, it's very quantitative. And part of the reason is, you know, if you don't speak the language, you can't do a kind of study of politics that's more about listening and, you know, non-quantitative measures. And I'm just wondering, you know, to what degree there's a kind of international dimension about, you know, certain students from countries in the developing world getting trained in places with better resources where they might be subject to these kinds of pressures, how that interacts in contexts where maybe at the domestic level there is that, you know, distance from these kinds of matrices because there's a recognition that maybe it's not embedded enough. But how do you think that kind of interacts, those kinds of contexts? Thanks.
Good evening. David Vose from University College London. It's fascinating stuff, and it strikes me that there's a sort of paradox that on the one hand, nearly every academic in Britain one talks to thinks that the ref is a nonsense. It's an enormous amount of time and effort that goes in to produce something that is highly predictable in terms of output. And so we wonder why we're all wasting our time doing this and hiring additional administrators and so on. But one at the same time, as has been said repeatedly, we're entirely complicit in supporting this exercise, and everybody from top to bottom seems to go along with it. Well, why is that the case? At the risk of sounding like an economist rather than a sociologist, I wonder if we don't need to look at incentives. And it seems to me that there are very few incentives to resist. Indeed, there are positive incentives not to do so. Whereas almost everybody in the structure either thinks that they will benefit from REF because they're strong and have good publications, or they're sufficiently aspirational that they think that they will have and that this will help them in getting promoted. Clearly, there's a power dynamic here in that the stronger individuals and the stronger departments and institutions are all in favor of something that ultimately is going to reinforce their own position in the hierarchy. When it comes to the question of how one does organize some sort of resistance, I wonder if we don't need to think about what incentives there could be for anybody to resist and how that might come about. Thank you.
Okay. So 5 minutes to respond. 5 minutes.
It's complicated. I mean, I think that the class issue or the class dynamic that is behind this is, of course, really central, because the way the archetypical Weberian vocational academic thinks about the world is incredibly classed. And because that tends to be the archetype that people not necessarily practice but have. It does a lot of normative work within the discipline and within disciplines in general. And I think that that is part of the problem. If we saw this as work, as labor, the same kind of labor that happens in a factory, I think we would have a different relationship with knowledge and with managers than what we currently do, because it's the relation is still given and framed by essentially elite ideas of how you live a life. And this idea of players versus, oh, I forgot the name, it's like a way of representing gentlemen versus, it's a, yeah. So it's there. And that's what is, I think, behind some of these dynamics. And there's there were other questions, but I forgot. Oh, no. So what are the incentives? Like, of course, one of the issues is that we also don't have too many incentives to fight against this, even though an incentive might just be having a better work environment where we don't have to produce articles that all look alike, because that is the pressure. It's that, as simple as that, having the ability to have a lifestyle that is more consistent with what you truly want to do, that is still a robust, important contribution to knowledge, than what is expected in terms of numbers of outputs that you need to pump out. Because that's what ends up happening. Things end up looking all the same, and there's very little actual added social value to all that production, because we effectively become workers in a factory without recognizing them and acting as if we're all members of an elite. And that is, again, at the core of these problems, I think. And breaking that is, of course, incredibly difficult. It's complex, it's complicated. It's not something simple. But I think that taking individual actions at the levels of how we think about others and how we evaluate others in certain circumstances and situations is already a step away from, and recognizing, of course, that this is all labor, is a step away from reproducing these dynamics.
And the international.
Oh, the international. So my experience from Mexico is that that is stratified. So elite institutions in Ghana must have, again, more international-oriented ideas maybe, and more quantitative takes. So then that is really cool. I mean, I guess that if there's a process of economizing things in the way the ref did so, you would expect to see a turn towards international journals. That's something that happened in Mexico, but the way it happened in Mexico was through personal incentives that were tied to productivity, and those incentives were also tied to the impact factor of journals. And local journals tend to have a lower impact factor, so immediately it makes people publish in international journals. And that created all these changes in Mexican academia that are very much stratified. Elite institutions are much more Americanized, and sort of non-elite institutions publish more in Spanish.
Okay, thank you for that. I mean, there's been so much here, and in part there's this sense that quantification is one part of the broader politics of knowledge production. And we have the geospatial distribution of the academy as well, and what it means, and the fact that we're so obsessed with forms of quantification and measurement here that it's a surprise that elsewhere people perhaps value and still continue to reproduce other values in the scholarship that they're producing, because the knowledge is for something. And I think this comes back to, in a sense, the question you were asking, you know, what is the purpose of the work we do? If we have a purpose beyond the politics of the academy, but are interested in the politics of the world within which we live, then there'll be different things that are important to us in that context. But thank you very much for talking to us about the book, for the reflections on the book and the questions. And I'll just pass over to Fran to close the session.
Thank you, Gurminder, and thank you to JP and the members of our panel, and I hope you will stay. I realise I forgot to do the fire drill instructions at the start, which was my real role, but we have got through all of this, and I did appreciate the juxtaposition of this image with the pretty depressing analyses that we were hearing in the in the exchange. Please do stay and have a drink and ask JP some more tough questions outside. But thank you all for being here and for your engagement. And thank you very much to our panel members.